Good afternoon, and welcome to Who's in the Kitchen. I'm Philothea Beeson, and you're listening to WDRT Community Radio 91.9 FM from Viroqua, Wisconsin, and streaming live on the internet at WDRT.org, where you can also go to listen to podcasts of previous shows. The last Saturday of every month, I am going to branch off and devote a show to food and farming. This show is the very first one, and I have the pleasure of having a guest, Alan Filo, from outside of Dodgeville, Wisconsin. Alan is a friend of mine, and we have talked a number of times about farming and food raising and animal raising and so forth, and he has a lot of experience and formal education as well. So, we're going to call the news segment Farming Digging Deep. And this isn't your typical farming show, I hope. So, Alan, were you always a farmer? Were you raised on a farm?
No, I wasn't. My background is that I was born out in ranch country in South Dakota, but when I was about four, my family moved to central Iowa. My mom was a teacher. My dad for a while did a bunch of odd jobs, ended up working at like an Oscar Mayer plant as a meat packer, or actually he was a ham deboner on the line. And then they closed that plant down and he eventually went back and retrained as a nurse. But I was a generation removed from the farm. My grandfather on my mother's side had originally started a farm with his father in Nevada, Iowa. But they had to close that down when his mother got cancer, and they had to sell the farm off. And he worked as a herdsman in the Amana colonies in Iowa, and eventually went on and got a job as an extension agent in near Lamar's, Iowa, up in the northwest corner of Iowa. But then he actually was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. And so the family just kind of slowly dropped out of agriculture due to these things. On my dad's side, he grew up on a farm in the Matanuska Valley of Alaska. It was at a time when the government was trying to push dairy farming in Alaska. And interestingly enough, they were actually recruiting people from Wisconsin to come up and dairy farm in Alaska. But it didn't work out very well. Alaska isn't a very good place to dairy farm. And so eventually my grandfather stopped dairy farming and retrained as an airplane mechanic and turned the pasture into a landing strip and the milking barn into a workshop / hangar. And that's how that side of the family, you know, left farming. So I was a full generation removed, and I wasn't even interested in it when I was growing up in high school. And I really didn't get interested in it until I eventually moved to West Virginia for a period of time. And when I moved back to the Midwest in my mid-20s, I had enough experience that I got a job working as a field operations manager at Gardens of Egan, which is a farm that is no longer going, but was a farm that was started by Martin and Atina Diffley and was a long-standing organic farm that made a lot of organic produce that got sold into the Twin Cities at the Wedge Co-op and into the other co-ops in the Twin Cities. And when I got a job there, it had been bought by one of those co-ops and was not being run by Martin and Atina anymore. And so I was part of the kind of management team that was managing that farm. And so I was in charge of crop rotations, field tillage, a lot of like equipment maintenance and planning rotations and doing cover cropping and fertility applications. And then from there, I worked there for about 3 years. And then that was a great job, and it was a great learning experience. Linda Holly was running the farm at the time. She now runs an operation over near Milwaukee. She's been, for a long time, she's been a major part of the organic community. She was actually with her partner at the time, Richard DeWild. She was awarded the Farmer of the Year by Moses, which is now called, I think, Marble Seed, but Midwest Organic Sustainable Education Service had awarded her the Farmer of the Year. So she was she's a longstanding member of the community, organic community. So I worked there for 3 years, and that was a really good job, but it didn't provide health insurance or things like that. And my first wife and I were ready to start a family at that time. And I got an offer to work for Midwestern BioAg, which is a company that's located in Blue Mounds, Wisconsin. Gary Zimmer was the owner and president. Since then, the company has passed on to different ownership. He's still actively involved. But they asked me to come over and start a specialty crop / vegetable program. And what they were, their company sold fertilizer both to organic and conventional farmers. They did a lot of soil, like consultation work, soil consultation work. So they would take soil tests. We would take soil tests, and we would look at your soil test, and we would go through that soil test with you and develop a fertility program. And they still do this kind of work, and they're very good at it. And Gary Zimmer was extremely gracious, and he asked me to, actually, he didn't ask me. I started the job, and like the day or two after I started the job, he told me that I was going back to school, because at that time I only had an associate's degree. And this was in like about 2011, 2012. And he told me, you're going to go back to school, and you can get a finish your degree in any thing related to agriculture that you want. But we want you to go back and finish your degree, and we'll give you the time to do it.
Oh, my gosh.
Which was just extremely generous, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't an option. Like, that was, I was being told that that was what I was to go do. So I did a year just to kind of get back. I haven't been in school for years, and so to get back into that, I went and enrolled at Platteville, and I did a year down in Platteville, and then I transferred up to the University of Wisconsin-Madison into the soils department, and worked through it going part-time. You know, it took 4 years to finish, you know, what was the equivalent of 2 years of school. And graduated with a degree in soils from the University of Wisconsin in 2016. And the University of Wisconsin is unique in the fact that it is one of only two, and this was at the time, and the other one may have closed by now, but it was one of two, only two universities in the United States left that had a completely independent soils department that provided undergraduate degrees just in soils. So, and it was also one of the first universities to do that. So it's a very established place with a long history of soils. We'll probably end up talking some about F.H. King, who was one of their first professors of what was called agricultural physics at the time. And one of the building attached to the soils building is the F.H. King building. And he wrote some very seminal works about agriculture in the early 1900s. And then after I graduated, Midwestern BioAg had changed a lot, and I moved on and began working for a company called BioStar Renewables, which is a company out of Kansas City. And they had developed a process for cleaning up digestate, or basically like dirty, quote unquote, dirty water streams. So when the way that we do agriculture presently in this country, there are a lot of, you know, CAFOs, confined animal operations, and these produce large amounts of manure. You know, so for instance, just to think through this for a minute to get an idea of just what these operations look like, if I take 5,000 cows and I concentrate them in barns that occupy roughly an acre to an acre and a half, that's the equivalent of 50,000 people living on an acre to an acre and a half. So it's pretty easy to see that if that was people, we would have a huge sewage problem, right? So, but this is a very efficient way in a lot of ways of doing animal production or doing milk production. I'm just using the word efficient. That's not like a judgment. It's just saying that from terms of economic efficiency, this is something that the economic system that we reside in presently makes very economically efficient, and that's why farmers do it. So we take that waste. Something has to be done with that waste. So a lot of what's being done with those waste streams is they're put into things called anaerobic digesters, which take the manure, and that manure gets digested by microbes and it produces methane. And that methane is cleaned up and it can be put in the natural gas pipeline. And it's a completely carbon neutral, it's a completely carbon neutral form of fuel because it's just coming from plants. So the plants had sucked CO2 out of the air, and then the microbes are just taking that CO2 and they're transforming it into methane. And when it's burnt, it goes back to being CO2. So there's no new carbon released into the atmosphere through this process. And then, but then you still have, that only results in about a 30% reduction in the total volume of these manures. And so you have something that needs to be done with the rest of the solids. And then you basically have a whole bunch of dirty water. But that dirty water is full of nutrients. And so this company, BioStar Renewables, had developed a process basically to take those nutrients and concentrate them. So like if we start with 100,000 gallons of manure, by the time we're done with our process, we make about 1,200 to 2,000 gallons of a finished organic high nitrogen fertilizer that is can be used in organic agriculture. And then we make like 75,000 gallons of dischargeable water. Water that can actually be fed back into the operation. For instance, we've had veterinarians allow for that water to be fed back to the animals, or we can get EPA discharge permits and take that water and put it into a stream because it has no deleterious effects on the riparian environment. So
that's very interesting because that's been one of my concerns, and I don't know enough about confined animal feedlot operations, and there are people putting energy into trying to remediate some of the problems with CAFOs.
Oh yeah,
the waste. It's a
major issue right now. It's been recognized, I'd say, over the last decade that those operations, and not, by the way, I want to make this really clear, not because of bad manure management practices at the facilities. It's not like we're talking about like that manure is spilling out of bunkers and getting into streams or and things like that. But basically, when you have that many animals in an area, and you have to get that manure back out to the farm fields. Well, the problem is that manure has a large quantity of water in it, and it takes trucks and therefore fuel and time and human labor to get that manure back out to the fields. And the farther I take that manure back out of the fields, well, the more expensive it is. And so as we've recognized that you can only put so much manure on soils before certain nutrients build up in them too much.
Oh, okay.
Right, and that there you can only put so much manure on at any given time. And these things are being legislated. Like you can't, you know, go past a certain amount of phosphorus applications in the soil at any given time in Wisconsin. And so what happens is the farmers basically just have to look for solutions when it becomes too expensive for them to truck that manure farther and farther away.
Mm-hmm.
So in economic terms, what we would say is that we've taken a externalized cost. For a long time, that particular cost had been externalized, or actually in a lot of ways, when you know, even 30 or 40 years ago when there were a lot more small dairies, that manure was just spread out in the environment and could get to a lot farther, a lot more distributed fields, right? Because there's a farm over here and there's another, you know, a half mile away, there's a farm over here and a half mile, there's a farm over here. So it's easier to get that manure back distributed out. So basically we're taking an externalized cost and we're causing that cost to be re-internalized. by agriculture. And in doing so, what usually happens when that sort of economic thing happens is people realize that there's probably value in it, or there's more things that can be done with it. And so that's where biogas, you know, when we first started doing this process, we would actually just flare the biogas off because it wasn't valuable. But since then, like California has put in place legislation that made that gas very valuable because it's a carbon neutral gas. And so it became possible to sell that gas. So now this thing that looked like a waste stream where it has now become a value stream mm-hmm. for the farmers.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of that happening in agriculture. And frankly, in America, that's kind of how we like to solve problems, right? We tend not to take a really heavy-handed approach and tell people you have to stop doing this, you have to handle this problem this way. Usually we just tend to make the problem really expensive, and then people figure out ways to gain value from solving the problem,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically what's happening then. So that's the company I work for now, and I work as their chief agronomist and head of product development. And we have projects going on across the country. We were actually just awarded. There were a series of climate smart agriculture grants that the government made about $3 billion worth of money available for climate smart agriculture, and it was a grant program. And we were just awarded to be part of one of those grants together with Raceline Energy to keep developing processes like this. It was an $80 million grant. So you know, we're very active out there, you know, in agribusiness. But in addition to that, my wife Sherry Nolden, who actually has appeared on your show before, own a farm by Dodgeville that is 130 acres of ground that we own. And then we rent about another, I'd say 50 or 60 acres. So we're kind of in that range of farming about 180 to 200 acres altogether. And we raise Norwegian Fjord horses. We have a registered herd of Norwegian Fjord horses. And that's a broodmare herd. So we breed Norwegian Fjord horses and we sell the foals. And we run that like a cow-calf operation. We do rotational grazing. And then we also raise goats and sheep, and we are trying to build up our herd to have about 600 breeding ewes and does of small ruminants, and those are all meat animals, so we sell those at auction for meat. So I have at this point, even though you know, where this question started is I didn't grow up in agriculture, but I've become very involved in it over time, and both actively farming and then working in agribusiness.
This is really great, and I just want to pause and say you're listening to WDRT Community Radio 91.9 coming from Viroqua, Wisconsin. And you can listen to this show again on our podcast if you go to the archives on WDRT.org. And I'm talking with Alan Filo, and I am so delighted to do this because I've known Alan for a few years, and I've never gotten to hear this summary of his journey into modern agriculture. I mean, this is just fascinating to me, and I'm so glad to share it with you. And you probably will want to either take notes or go back and listen to it again because it's just amazing. And it makes me feel hopeful personally that some of the problems that have been developed in modern agriculture are also getting to be, you know, have some positive solutions. So this is part of a new show series that I'm going to be doing. It's going to be airing the last Saturday of every month at noon. Farming, digging deep, and that's what we're doing. And I hope that you will tune in to WDRT on Saturday mornings at noon for the last Saturday of the month and listen to really some excellent in farming. And I'm so glad, Alan, that you know, you're not only somebody who's, you know, got a degree and been to school, and you're not only somebody that's in agribusiness, but you really have a farm and you really are doing this. And so it makes it so well-rounded, and I'm really enjoying hearing about your journey in agriculture. So I hope people have sort of an idea of who I'm talking to now. Alan lives out by Dodgeville, and I have been out to his farm. And yes, I have talked with Sherry, and I realize, you know, I just go to the feed mill and buy feed. I don't really know that much. I don't know that much about what's in my pasture. I don't, you know, I just get chicken feed, or, you know, I'm just not that well versed. And I realize that Alan and Sherry are people that really pay attention to their soil and their crops, to the weeds, to sylvan farming, you know, several different layers, not just what's coming, you know, in grasses and so forth, but in shrubs and trees. And there's just so much more to it. And I'm not a farmer, but I'm pretty naive. So I'm hoping to share this, information with you about farming. And so let's continue with our discussion.
Sure. When you told me about the series and you had asked me what you thought we would want to talk about, you know, my suggestion is, why don't we start with a little bit of like a history of agriculture? Because it's very hard to know where it is we are if we don't know where it is that we came from or how we got here.
Mm-hmm.
And agriculture is very old, right? Agriculture goes back, you know, basically to this, even before the start of what we call civilizations. So when we were talking about this, you know, it would potentially be easy to pick a point to start at, you know, and do like a history of American agriculture. But my opinion is like, it's best to go all the way back to the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we don't live in a Garden of Eden where everything just grows and we just pick it.
So agriculture has its origins in the Fertile Crescent, kind of before even civilization, as we would call it, really started, before we know of any developed writing systems or anything that we can recognize as like an active civilization. And the Fertile Crescent, for those of you who aren't familiar with that term, is an area that goes from Egypt on the southwestern portion of the Fertile Crescent, stretches up through Palestine, Israel, Syria, up into the southern, very southern portions of Anatolia, which is modern day Turkey, and then turns, and to make a crescent on a map, then turns and goes down and follows the Tigris and Euphrates rivers down through Mesopotamia in modern day Iraq. And this is where we find the very first evidence of farming that we can find in the archaeological record. And it doesn't start down in the river valleys. It started in the kind of surrounding hill areas of the Fertile Crescent. So the oldest continuously inhabited city that we know of, I believe, is Jericho. And that's a city in Israel that is up in the hills. And it's very interesting because when you go to that part of the world, you can still find wild patches of the very first grains that humans ever domesticated. In fact, you can still find them in patches where you could harvest them and you would have enough food to feed a family for a year. And that's just growing wild out there. And what happened, what appears to have happened over time, and there's a few particular grains that this was done with, oats, barley, einkorn, and emmer wheat, were some of the first grains to be domesticated. But it basically looks like people were gathering those, and then they just started tending them a little bit, like to make it easier to gather them. Now, we don't have any written records of this. A lot of this is just sort of assumption and trying to work through how you would go from these sort of wild landrace plants to the modern domesticated varieties. And And but what it appears is that people just started tending these patches. So you'll go in and just start removing some weeds.
So grains, are basically seeds from grasses.
Yes, grains are just grasses. Mm-hmm. Oats, wheat, barley, even corn. Now remember, like modern maize wasn't part of what was started being farmed over there in the Fertile Crescent. Maize, or what we call corn in America, actually came from Oaxaca in Central America. But that's kind of that comes into the story in the future. So what I'm really talking about right now is the origin of what's called the Southwestern Asia Agricultural Complex. And that is a series of crops and animals that were domesticated, and techniques for agriculture around them were developed in the Fertile Crescent in Southwestern Asia. And so again, that's those particular grasses, but that also includes goats, sheep, cows, and then eventually horses and pigs. So these were all things that kind of came into this that were domesticated in different ways around the same time. And so these grains, what people did was they started taking care of these grain patches, but then they also started saving some of the seeds. Or maybe they didn't eat all of the seeds over the course of winter, and they still had some, and so they would go and start putting them out onto the ground. And what's very interesting is the plants begin to change when you do this, because if you just think about this for a second, if I'm going to go save seeds from a wheat plant, what do you think I'm just naturally going to pick? Do you think I'm going to pick the smaller seeds or the bigger seeds?
Mm-hmm.
What would you pick?
Well, I pick the bigger, better seeds.
Right. And then in addition to that, there's interest the wild grasses. So the wild grasses need to be able to spread their seeds naturally, and so they do something called shattering. So when they become ripe, they fall off the head of the grass, right? Because they need to get back into contact with the soil. But if I'm a person harvesting grain, I, of course, am not going to pick up a head of wheat that shattered and is on the ground. I'm going to pick one that didn't shatter. And so you can see in just those two things, we already have selection criteria that have begun to happen. We're selecting for these really specific traits that make these plants easier for humans to grow and to use.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's as far as we can tell, that's the origin of agriculture. And it also had to do some with the climate in the area. So we think of that now as being a very, very like semi-arid, hot climate. But at the time that this was starting, it would have been just post the Ice Age, and it was a much cooler area, and there were a lot of kind of like oak forests in the area. But the tendency in that area since the Ice Age has been towards increasing heat and aridity, so hotter and drier. And what that does is that they think that it started a series of basically pulsating and unpredictable drought conditions every once in a while that actually encourage people to do more collecting and storing of food. That's the theory. Again, we don't have any written records of that. But what happened next was really interesting, because it's one thing to farm up on the tops of hills and to sort of do this tending of natural patches of grain producing grass, and it's a very different thing to suddenly go down into the river valleys where there's kind of loose, friable, easily plowable soils, and to start growing grains there. And river valleys are also interesting because they are a place where a lot of natural fertility collects. And so what we see in both the Tigris and Euphrates river valleys and in Egypt is that agriculture moves out of the hills and it moved down into the river valleys. And when it did that, it became very, very much more productive and became the basis for the start of what we think of as those first Southwestern Asian civilizations, like the Sumerians and the Akkadians and the Egyptians. And the form of agriculture that began to be practiced there really continued in pretty much in the form that it was practiced, with slight variations in the way that the tools were made, all the way down into the 1400s, when a lot of the infrastructure that was developed there to support that, which included a lot of irrigation canals and ditches, was destroyed by the Mongol invasions. But that was an area where very, very successful agriculture was practiced for thousands of years, with no real obvious long-term degradation of the environment. And the reason I say that is because those cultures kept farming there, and at three different times, there are only three different times in history that population levels have been reached in the Mesopotamian region that equal today, like the modern population levels, and that would be now, that would be just prior to the Mongol invasions, and then a period that is referred to as the Third Ur period, which for those of you who are interested in biblical history is the period in which Abraham left Ur. So that was actually an incredibly populous area of a very, very, very large population of people living there, completely developed cities, large trade networks, and all of this was based on this agriculture that came down out of the hills and began being practiced in these river valleys. And the tools and techniques that we use in agriculture today, still to this day, were basically developed during that time period. And these were very, very intelligent people. It can be really easy for us as modern peoples to look back in time and think of other peoples as being primitive or not, you know, using science to, you know, study what's going on around them and to be able to optimize, you know, yield. But what's interesting is when you look back, the ancient Sumerians had developed a kind of plow called a seed drill plow. You might recognize that we use both of those things today still in modern agriculture. We use seed drills and we use plows.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had developed a seed drill plow, and that very carefully placed barley at extremely regular intervals into the soil, and they reached, now, not on a, we tend to think of yields on a per acre basis, or if you're outside of the United States and you're using the international system, a per hectare basis, but they were not able to achieve the same kind of per acre yields that we can get today. But if you kind of recalibrate the way of thinking about this, and you think of, for each seed I put in the ground, what kind of increase do I get back?
Right.
So the modern barley gets about a 30x, a 30-time increase in the amount of seed. From when we plant one seed, we get about 30 barley seeds back. And the ancient Sumerians had reached that exact same return.
No kidding.
Yeah. If you're interested in looking at like ancient Sumerian and ancient Mesopotamian farming techniques, I mean, it's very fascinating. They had fields that were divided very specifically. They knew exactly how many people it took to farm a field. They knew exactly how many seeds it took to plant a field. They had forms of taxation that were based on exactly like this soil type should produce roughly this much, and so you should be paying this much in taxes. And I mean, it's a completely developed society that in a lot of ways we would just look at and sort of recognize,
mm-hmm,
as similar to today. But again, that's where agriculture really originated.
Mm-hmm.
And the agriculture that kind of predominates in the world today. And when I'm talking about this history of agriculture, I'm focusing on that Southwestern Asian agricultural complex, because that's what we've inherited today, you know, in the United States. It's kind of an odd thing to think about that the agriculture that we're doing in like an Iowa farm field or a Wisconsin farm field is directly tied back to what, like, this ancient Sumerian was doing 8,000 years ago. I mean, down to the fact that the wheat that you might plant, or the oats that you would plant, or the barley that you would plant, you're inheriting the selection criteria and the selection motivations of this Sumerian farmer from 8,000 years ago.
Right. You can go to the food co-op and buy emmer or einkorn wheat.
Yeah, and all of the modern wheat varieties have been bred out of those varieties.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so that's always something that strikes me when you're planting or when you're handling seed, is that in a way you're sort of holding a time capsule or a portal, you know, into the past, because I can imagine standing in a Sumerian wheat field, you know, and it probably wouldn't be a whole lot different than standing in a wheat field in, you know, Wisconsin today. So but that's also to say that agriculture has arisen at multiple has arisen independently at multiple locations around the world. It's arisen in several places in Africa. There's rice agriculture arose, it looks like, spontaneously in China. There's a form of agriculture that originated spontaneously in Papua New Guinea. And then there's at least two areas, and there might be more, but there's at least two areas in North and South America where agriculture also originated spontaneously. And those are Oaxaca, where our modern maize corn varieties come from. And then also down in, I believe it's Peru, I might have the location slightly off, but it's basically where Incan style agriculture developed, and so like potato agriculture, and where a lot of those varieties were developed. What's interesting is that most of the time, when you look at why agriculture developed wherever it developed kind of around the same criterion that I described it developing in the Fertile Crescent. It developed in areas where there were beginning to be climate fluctuations, where populations were high enough where it made sense for people to invest more in intensified forms of managing their food, right? And that they were trying to maintain populations that had been built up in maybe one kind of environment, and then as that climate and environment was shifting maybe to a drier or more arid form, they were forced to intensify their efforts in food production in order to maintain that population level. So there's a relatedness wherever agriculture was developed, but again, we're just focusing on this southwestern Asian agricultural complex, because that's really what we've inherited today.
Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking about farming as contrasted to, grazing, nomadic type of subsistence, where you weren't fixed on a particular place, or maybe you had a range of places throughout the year, the different seasons, and you moved, which is a little bit different. It's not exactly the agriculture of, you know, saving seeds and planting them and staying in one place.
Yeah, that's correct. But the two seem to be highly interrelated.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. In a lot of ways. What you kind of see often is this periphery of nomadic societies producing, you know, doing that more subsistence-based living, and then living on the fringes of these settled societies.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that there's a lot of cultural exchange of goods and of livestock. You know, they think that horses were originally domesticated just north of the Black Sea in modern-day Ukraine, and those societies that had domesticated the horses, it's the settled societies looking at those horses and thinking, how useful and, you know, in those societies how tasty those animals looked, and began trading those horses into these settled societies. And the same with different versions of cattle and sheep and goats. And but that interchange also is not often very peaceful. You know, what happens with settled societies is that there's a lot of wealth that builds up in a settled society. You know, agriculture is the basis of wealth of all of these ancient societies. It puts me in mind of this quote from Benjamin Franklin. And Benjamin Franklin said that there's three ways that a society, a country, can enrich itself. He said the first is war, which is basically stealing. The second is commerce, which is just legalized cheating. And the third is agriculture, which he calls the only honest way of producing wealth. And so what you get is you would get a lot of wealth building up in these settled societies, and then you would have nomads that sort of started to covet that wealth and would come in and take what they wanted. So there's a long and storied interchange between those settled and non-settled populations. But what's interesting is in the end, the settled form of life, this farming way of life, tends to win because it produces more people. And, you know, we don't tend to think of it this way because we live in a modern world of engines and machines. But, you know, before the invention of engines and machines, the way to measure kind of the power of a particular people was how many people are there and how many animals do they have? Because that's the basis of what you can do for work or war or any of those various ways of measuring the strength of a society. And agricultural societies produce more people and therefore have a much stronger power base. And that's why you see that mode of life then start to spread outside of the Fertile Crescent. It spreads up into all of Anatolia, and it spreads over into Greece and the Phoenicians and the Levant from Tyre and Sidon start going all across the Mediterranean and planting colonies like Carthage, or the French city of Marseille started out as a Phoenician / Greek colony, you know, back in, you know, maybe 1000 BC. And as these as those societies went places and spread, they took agriculture with them, and you see these little pockets of agriculture start to grow all around the Mediterranean. But that agriculture kind of stayed there for a long time because all of the plants and all of the animals that had become part of that agricultural complex were all adapted to that kind of environment, that kind of Mediterranean environment.
Mm-hmm.
So as agricultural spread, as agriculture spread, it only spread into those areas where those seeds and techniques were adapted to be able to survive. So it's very interesting. There's this place in, I believe it's modern day Romania or Bulgaria, it's somewhere down in that Balkan area, and it's called the Balkan Gates. And it's this interesting place where agriculture sort of got to and then stopped for 1,000 years, and it didn't spread past this place where this river comes through this set of hills that people call the Balkan Gates. And then something happened. It could have been a cultural interplay, it could have been a mutation and an adaptation in seed genetics, but suddenly, all of a sudden, when you look at the historical record of farming kind of gets stuck at those Balkan Gates for 1,000 years, and then suddenly spreads pretty much all the way across Europe within a couple hundred years. And that's really when that Southwestern Asian agricultural complex grew majorly outside of that original area and that original climate that it was developed in.
Mm.
But what happens is, you know, to go back to thinking about how that original agriculture worked, that agriculture that was developed in these river valleys, the tools, the techniques, the amounts of fertility that you could expect to receive from flooding and that can regenerate your soils and the fertility of your soils, those were all developed in river valley systems.
Right.
And, And when it spread across the Mediterranean, it tended to spread to river valley systems first. But then as population levels increase and as agriculture spreads, it spreads out of river valleys, and these techniques that were developed for river valleys suddenly get taken up into hills or forests or different places. And what we usually see is that, and we're still struggling with this today, many of the debates that you see in modern agriculture today, to me, look like they originate from the way that we developed farming, and then what happens when you take that kind of farming to a place that isn't that same kind of environment, right? A river valley is an interesting environment because, first of all, it actually doesn't take, it's an easier soil to till, right? It's an easier soil to remove the plant cover because they tend to be very loose soils because they're soils that are made from regular alluvial deposits, basically like regular deposits of eroded materials from upstream, right? Delta areas and things like this. And so, and also you get a huge benefit from plowing these soils, from opening these soils up, because those river valleys tend to accumulate a lot of organic matter in them. And organic matter isn't just, you know, when we look at it, we see something that's maybe, you know, gives the soil this black color. But when you look at organic matter on a molecular level, organic matter has all sorts of interesting things in it. It's primarily carbon, but it also has, you know, a certain amount of nitrogen in it. I think it's usually about, this number might be slightly off, but it's usually about 5% nitrogen. Nitrogen is one of the most limiting elements for plant growth that anywhere. It doesn't matter if it's in agriculture or if it's in any sort of like natural undisturbed ecosystem. And what happens is when you get these concentrations of organic matter in this silt, and then you open that up and you expose it to air, the microbes in the soil go and eat that organic matter, because it's an energy source for them. It has those carbon chains that the organic matter is made out of. When it gets broken apart, they can extract energy from that. It's actually just kind of different. You can think of it as a more complex form of sugar, right? When you look at sugar, sugar is just a series of carbon chains, and our bodies take it, and they break the carbon chains apart, and there's energy in those bonds, and then you get the energy out of that. Well, microbes can do it with lots and lots of different materials. But when you open those soils up, they need air to do it in the most efficient manner and to extract the most energy from it. But what happens is the energy, they'll break that energy apart and they'll suck in a lot of the nutrients associated with it. And then you kind of get this downcycling of there's less energy in the system, right? Because they used up some of the energy, but they still have these other nutrients in them. And then there's the next generation doesn't have as much energy to be able to process. And so you get less microbes going forward. And so some of them die off. And when they die off, it releases these nutrients, the nitrogen, the phosphorus, the potassium that's in their little microbe bodies. It releases them into the environment. And plants pick them up and use them for growth. And so this is why we do tillage. This is why tillage was invented, because it's a practical way of increasing the total amount of nutrients that are available to plants in a soil.
Oh, I see. Just as opposed to just undisturbed soil and what it's going to yield.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Right?
Okay. And we just are about out of time for this session of Digging Deep in Farming.
So I'll finish up by saying this then about plowing. So in a river valley, there aren't a whole lot of consequences to that, because you can do that and you can break down this organic matter, but that's okay, because like if you're in Egypt, you're going to get more next year on schedule. Or in the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, it wasn't that regular, but it was pretty regular. You were going to get a new injection of organic matter and a new injection of fertility.
Through water.
Through water and through silt and through mud, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. the natural deposit. And so this technique of plowing and of tillage is perfectly reasonable to use in a river valley. because there's not, you're not going to get the long-term degradation of a soil that isn't receiving those that you might in a flatland area around the river valley, like up higher on a plateau. Those soils might begin breaking down through plowing because they're not getting that regular influx. So that would be a good place to leave it, because we've kind of covered where agriculture started and why the tools were developed to do agriculture. And next time we could start talking about a little bit more about that spread of agriculture and those tools, and looking at kind of what happened in the Roman Empire and the Middle Ages, and then the clash of the old and new worlds and what that meant for farming.
Mm-hmm. This has just been fascinating, and I think it should be just farming 101 for everybody. Thank you so much. I've been talking with Alan Filo. He lives in Dodgeville. He's just talking about this from the top of his head. It's just amazing. And I really appreciate you sharing this with us, Alan. And this is part of a new series that I'm doing called Farming, Digging Deep. And it's going to be aired every final Saturday of every month. So if you're really interested in this topic, that's when you can tune in to WDRT 91.9 FM, coming from Viroqua, Wisconsin. I'm Philothea Beeson. I'm also the producer for Who's in the Kitchen, and I've been so interested in the farming aspect related to food that I decided to start this series on farming. So I hope you'll tune in, tell your friends about this new show. Thank you so much, Alan, for starting us out in this wonderful, profound way. Very, very interesting and fun. So,
thank you for having me on.
Okay. Thank you to my listeners for tuning in to WDRT, Dirt Radio from the Ground Up.